Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all parties are in listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's call. If you wish to ask a question at that time, please press star 1 on your phone, unmute your phone, and record your name so you can be announced for your question. Today's call is also being recorded. If anyone disagrees, you may disconnect at this time. It is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Mr. Anthony Sargis. Thank you, and you may begin.
Thank you, Sandy. Appreciate it. Welcome back, everyone, to our special topic conference call series. Again, I'm Tony Sargis, Senior International Trade Specialist with the U.S. Department of Commerce Connecticut Export Assistance Center. I'm just going to cover a few housekeeping items, and then I'm going to turn it over to our speakers. So first, we have listed on the Connecticut District Export Council website all the reference materials from this series over the last 3 or 4 weeks, including recordings, presentations, the list of speakers, and contact information. You should have received an email this morning, a reminder for this call. So if you look at that email, you should have the link there. And if you don't have that, please send me a note and I can get you the link to that landing page with all of that information. Just a note, today's call is just a conference call. There's no webinar or presentation portion for today. So you're not missing out on anything. It'll just be through the phone. After Greg and Joe's remarks, the operator will provide instructions on how to ask a question. Today's presenters will be discussing key issues regarding insurance coverages, both business interruption, cyber, and vacancy of buildings, in addition, how to get premium relief in the short term, as well as how to prepare potential liability issues in regards to employees coming back to work after shelter in place is lifted. Our experts today include Greg Podolik, partner at Sachs, Dornberger, and Vita, and Joe Smith, president and CEO of Smith Brothers. I'm going to turn it over to Greg to start, and then Joe's good. They're going to have some dialogue, and then we'll take questions at the end. So, Greg.
All right. Well, thank you, Tony, and thank you to the audience for joining us today, and thank you to Joe for collaborating with me on this. Some brief background on me so that you have the benefit of my perspective and where I'm coming from. So I am a corporate insurance recovery attorney. My practice is exclusively focused on working with policyholders, insurance policyholders, as they strategize placing insurance programs, pursuing claims. That's all I do. That's all my entire firm does. We are headquartered in Connecticut, but serving clients throughout the entire country. And one of the things I love about the dynamic that we've got set up for today, and before I kind of get things rolling, I'd like to give Joe an opportunity to introduce himself, is that it's a great juxtaposition for me to be able to offer perspective on legal implications, legal evaluations, and legal strategies as it relates to the various types of concerns that we're going to be talking about today and how certain policies respond. And contrast that with Joe's perspective about how the marketplace functions and what some of the practical effects of those legal implications may be. It really offers for a well-rounded perspective. And when I talk with clients about, as they're working on placing insurance programs and we're talking about best practices for structuring the program legally or word usage and things of that nature, I often tell them, look, there's a legal gold standard for anything, but the question ultimately is what's the best balance of finding the best legal, result to address something, and what does the market yield? And so as we proceed today, I think Joe and I are really going to be trying to offer that kind of balance of perspective. And so I'll take a beat for a moment before we kind of jump in and ask Joe to introduce himself.
Okay, thanks, Greg and Tony. Appreciate it. I'm Joe Smith, President and CEO of Smith Brothers, and we're a broker, agent, and consultant in the insurance world, and we are not an underwriter. We're not a carrier. We either represent the carriers and or represent the clients to the carriers. And so I hope to bring a perspective. This is a very stressful time for everybody, health-wise, but also economically, and there's a lot swirling around in our industry right now, and I'm hoping to be able to add some value by giving you perspective of how the insurance marketplace is responding to this or not, and also let you know that we do work with Greg's firm, SDV. We've consistently worked with them on doing that balance that Greg just mentioned, which is the legal interpretation of the contracts in the market yield, I think is the word that Greg used, I like, and how that can play out in these situations that we're now in. So I'm happy to be here, and I hope I can answer as many questions as we can. I think Greg and I will both be saying the same thing in many of these instances. Policies are held by policyholders, differ amongst policyholders, differ amongst carriers, and so we'll be as specific as we can, but often it's going to require a deep dive by your attorney or your broker. But thanks, and I hope we can add some value to this conversation.
All right, so I'll get us rolling, and I think maybe the best way in some sense to do that is to try and give a snapshot of a conversation I think I've had maybe several hundred times over the last couple of months, and it's probably similar to what many of you have experienced on the phone, and certainly I'm sure Joe has lived the same thing, and that is a conversation with clients that come in and say, what do I make of this? What do I do? And how do I put some sort of a structure institutionally within my company and for the stakeholders to whom I have to report about how we're going to manage this process? How do I wrap my arms around understanding what this actually means? I think Joe made a note in his comments, his initial remarks, and it's an important one that I think we're going to come back to a few times throughout this afternoon, and that is there really is no one-size-fits-all answer for this, for how you manage your insurance resources for the issues that you're dealing with. The real key is being able to understand what comprises that program and working closely with the insurance thought leaders within your company or the insurance advisors that you regularly work with to understand the nuances, because there is a lot of commentary that's out there. You Google anything having to do with COVID-19 or coronavirus and insurance recovery these days, you are going to get overwhelmed with Google results that tell you up is down is up, and everything in between. And the real answer lies in the details of your specific insurance policy contract. So it is critical for all the things that we talk about today that you have some intimate familiarity with the specific components. We're going to talk about the common issues that come up, but those details matter because, again, from a legal perspective, that is a contract that you've got with your insurance company. And so all of those details matter, and for many of the common issues that come up, there is most likely a series of case law that tells you what certain words mean, how they apply, and anytime there's going to be the presentation of a claim and potential negotiation and resolution of a claim, to some extent, that legal authority is coming to bear on how carriers interpret their policies and whether and when they decide they're going to resolve the payment of a claim. What I usually start by telling folks is, it is, in addition to being sensitive to that, the individual circumstances with which you're dealing, that also means it's important as you wade into that process to define success for yourself. Some people will tend to think of this as they, you know, as they're reading up on articles, and certainly if you read most of them, this is, I think, how most people are trying to position certain key issues as a relatively binary question. Is it covered or isn't it covered? And the answer is not that simple. So as you get into specific issues, it's about understanding, all right, what did we reasonably already purchase as part of our insurance program? How does that work? And what are the best opportunities for maximizing recovery? And that's a term I use often. I think it's important to put it into proper context. Like I said at the outset, I am an insurance recovery litigator. So the perspective I bring to the table is often advising my clients about, realistically, what is your insurance product designed to do? What will the court say that it does? And how do you find the best opportunity for getting the most value out of that product you purchased? The key issue right off the bat, as I have many of those conversations with my clients, is I'm experiencing a loss now. Either, depending on the industry, I'm absorbing additional costs in order to mitigate the potential effects of COVID-19, I'm losing rental value, I'm losing customers, I'm bleeding cash. Where do I go for that? And so the process I typically start with people is to help them organize. Off the bat, I think it's important to keep in mind your entire insurance program. Start from a place of looking at all that you have and trying to identify where there may be opportunities for a policy to respond. And as we focus on those things where, cash issues dictate early on, everybody's asking the same question. Do I have business interruption coverage? And this is a prime example of what I mentioned before about there being a lot of generic commentary about what business interruption coverage is and how it works. One of the key issues that comes up on most policies, and you'll find customarily, you're going to find business interruption coverage as part of a commercial property insurance policy. Now, keeping this somewhat organized, where does that fit in the grand scheme of things? So a commercial property policy, like a homeowner's policy, like an auto policy, it provides a first-party coverage. And as we organize things, we're prioritizing that because it's a policy that, if there's coverage, is going to pay for those out-of-pocket first-party expenses or losses that are being incurred, as opposed to a third-party liability policy, which at some point will respond to provide a defense if your entity gets sued by a third party. For most people, we're not there yet. So it's the first party exposures that we prioritize, and as a result, it's the first party policies that we prioritize. The key issue that most people are talking about when it comes to business interruption coverage is whether there is a direct physical loss or not. And that comes part and parcel of the coverage being customarily provided through a commercial property policy. And the simple answer, if there is a simple answer, is that whether the presence of COVID-19 or coronavirus is a direct physical loss or damage, it depends. It depends on how the courts in a particular jurisdiction have interpreted those terms, direct physical loss or damage. And what many carriers, I think, are taking as a first position on these issues is that it is not, the presence of COVID-19 is not a direct physical loss. There are cases throughout the country that have gone in different directions in similar scenarios. Now, I say similar because there isn't anything quite like this that's come before. But the best bellwethers we can find suggest that it's at least an open and debatable issue. And I think this might actually be a good opportunity for me to take a pause for a second and invite Joe's commentary, because what I'm, as that conversation with my clients evolves, a lot of what we talk about is, look, knowing that that is potentially a debatable issue, what's the appropriate tactic for organizing and submitting a claim? Should I bother? Should I not? And a lot of times the conclusion that my clients reach is, yes, it's appropriate to organize and track the losses that we're having, to put our carriers on notice, and to start a dialogue about those issues to see how they may respond on the coverage and whether this becomes a critical issue. And, Joe, on your front, what are you seeing at that phase of the process?
Yeah, so kind of reiterate that we've been advising clients after discussion to default to putting a claim in to the property policies if they have them, and knowing and kind of giving them an expectation of how the industry's been reacting. And the industry, the carriers, have been, every policy's different. But however, the two issues that have come up in denials are the virus exclusion or some form of it that may or may not be in the policies, but in the mid-2000s became very common on the standard forms to have an exclusion for virus. And then the direct physical loss issue that Greg was just talking about. So what we're seeing is denials coming through on pretty much everything. We haven't had any claim accepted yet by a carrier due to those contractual limitations that are in the property policy. And so we do feel the exercise of putting it in after discussion with counsel and us is important to document to put the claim in, and then to continue to document your losses or damages. And we've given some guidance on how to do that, mainly because this will take some time to play out, as Greg can share with you in terms of challenges, but also because there's a lot going on at the federal level in terms of potential speculation now and not law that there may be some federal funds used to help with some of these losses. And so we're just advising to put it in, see what the denial says, assuming it'll be a denial, and then also keep yourself documented. So as this kind of rolls out, you're in a position to take advantage of anything that might be available outside of the treasury or the stimulus packages that have been put out there, but more specific to your property policy. But that's what we've been seeing is denials coming in on these because of the contractual language in 99.9% of these.
And Greg, I'm just going to interject with a question before you move on. And as far as, am I covered if the government forces my business to temporarily close? What if my geographic area is affected by a shelter-in-place rules? Would civil authority cover a potential loss? Could you discuss that?
Yes, certainly. That is a common scenario, too. And many of these policies also provide coverage for civil authority actions. In most instances, it's going to have the same baseline issue of the requirement of some sort of physical event. I'm going to sound like a broken record, but it really is critical to emphasize you've got to look very carefully at how your policy is written. Some policies may not require that in certain scenarios. But more often than not, in my experience, the direct physical loss event in that situation usually has to take place off-premises and trigger the government activity, or it ties in some other way. So I would reasonably anticipate that in most instances you're going to have that debate on some level. Joe, thoughts on that?
Yes, I mean it's it all triggers from the property policy language, and so if direct physical damage is an issue, then it would also be an issue for civil authority. And I think a question popped up as well, or may pop up on contingent business interruption. But once again, that coverage, which extends to kind of supply chain reliance on different physical locations, but also in many cases will require direct physical damage. So it's the same peril issue that we have of this COVID-19 and whether there's direct physical damage that the courts would uphold to. So those, I'll call them ancillary kind of extended coverages, still trigger and still are subject to the direct physical damage interpretation as well as the virus exclusion if you have one in the policy.
A continued word about direct physical loss, because I think this is important to really tease out so that people can understand the landscape. It's an area where you can absolutely expect some pushback. My advice to most folks is continue that dialogue, submit the claim, recognize that there may be arguments under your particular circumstances why that should be triggered, and also recognize that this is not an area where only one person, one entity, one company is having this dispute at one particular time. There is a nation of companies right now that are experiencing the exact same thing. As of today's count, I'm just checking my notes to make sure nothing new has popped up in the last 20 minutes, there are at least 20 individual lawsuits around the country that are principally about this issue of business interruption and direct physical loss or damage, each with some subtle variations, but that's the core theme for each of them. And that's not unsurprising given this scenario, where I think between the policyholder bar that I work with and the carrier bar, there is going to be a lot of jockeying to establish a narrative one way or the other. And some aggressive litigators are trying to get out in front of that and set the tone early. And that is, I would say, I wouldn't be surprised if that number was increased, by 10 or even 15 or 20 within the next week, because it's really begun to ratchet up in just the last week alone, as more people are beginning to see denials come through and see disputes with their carriers. And that can be important because as you're anybody on this call may be involved in their own claim submission and negotiation, they may be seeing a lot of recalcitrance from their carriers. And if that landscape starts to take hold, if those cases start to reach favorable results, they can be useful for individual negotiations. So it's important to keep that broader landscape in the back of your mind as you proceed. This is not a typical scenario where it's a one-to-one, in some sense, a one-to-one negotiation over one specific policy. It is because in the sense that each contract, each policy governs each individual case, but there is a national momentum that's happening here because so many people are experiencing and dealing with the same issues simultaneously.
Yeah, I think our experience as well has been the pushback or the denials and the discussions that we've had. I think ultimately, you can only imagine, if insurance in its rawest form was set up to, underwrite a risk and then fund losses for an individual subsidized by the remaining group that didn't have a loss or some formation of that, which is actuarial. This wasn't calculated, this entire country being in world, but in our case in the U.S., all at the same time having this business interruption due to the unique circumstances. The carriers, didn't rate that in. They didn't have that in their actuarial formulas, and therefore, in their mind, haven't collected the premium for it and certainly don't have the solvency levels to fund the entire nation's business interruption. So I think what Greg said is there are going to be a lot of one-on-one battles in addition to kind of overall how the courts see this. But there's also some legislative activity going on at the state levels and federal levels and with trying to, figure out if there's a way where the government can step in. And I think the most frictionless one that I've heard involves the federal government working with the property and casualty industry to form kind of a, what you would call a recovery fund or a federally backed recovery fund, like almost like we did after 9/11 with terrorism, and there was a TRIA fund where the federal government guaranteed and backed up losses regarding terrorism. There's some momentum at the federal level regarding doing a joint working relationship with the PNC industry to handle the claims on that funded by the government. Now, that's not been passed, and I'm sure in the political system we have, it won't be fast, but I do hear that there's some potential for that on both sides. So, and I think ultimately, like the PPP loans, Paycheck Protection Program loans, use the SBA approved lenders to distribute those stimulus funds. The concept is that might happen at the federal level with the property and casualty industry. And quite frankly, my personal opinion is that's the most frictionless way to get money into the hands of those, the businesses that have been affected, which is almost every business out there. So outside of that, there'll be a lot of, I think, legal litigation, and that's slow and costly. However, it is the reality of where we're at right now. So it's everything Greg's saying. I'm behind in terms of trying to go shoulder to shoulder to make sure we optimize whatever the policy gives.
Yeah, that's a really great point about the prospect of a federally funded program to address some of these issues. And in terms of similar types of mechanisms, I'd agree with you that at this early stage of the game, that seems like it has the most viability. And I would take a moment to emphasize to the audience that prospect is one of the reasons that Joe and I are routinely telling clients that even in the face of a very challenging insurance claim, let's say one that has a particularly broad virus exclusion, it is important to catalog your risk, your damages, maintain that information, and to proceed with the claim submission process and to get the denial, because oftentimes those types of programs, accessing them somewhere down the road may be predicated on having received a denial for a claim of this nature. So even if ultimately the conclusion is that there is no coverage, dotting those I's and crossing those T's can be important for other reasons down the road, and it's important not to just abandon the process. The other thing I'd note, and a lot of people on the phone may have some general awareness of, a number of different states have gone through various stages of trying to develop individual legislation to try and address these issues. And it commonly, I guess the way they're sort of generally being characterized is to provide or require the carriers, certain carriers, to provide business interruption coverage. What I'd say about that, without singling out any particular state and where they might be in the process, is that I think there are ways that legislation like that could or can be successful, but from the ones I've seen so far, I don't think that there is much of a prospect of them being successful for a variety of issues, not the least of which is legally what they purport to do. I don't know that the approach I've seen with many of them would survive a constitutional challenge. And I also think that practically the local insurance lobbies, from what I know from just general insight, have been very aggressive, not surprisingly, in pushing back on that. And so of the various draft bills we've seen, none, to my knowledge, have even come close to getting up to a vote yet. So in terms of relying on individual state legislation as an avenue for recourse in this arena, I wouldn't put it at the top of the priority list.
I think where you've seen, Greg, I think where we've seen reaction from the insurance carriers in regards to either, you know, the governors of the states or the insurance commissioner's guidance, call it strong guidance, has been in the areas of, which I hope the listeners have already started to recognize, but in the areas of deferral of premium payments over the next, you know, some cases up until June 1st at this point, where you can defer your premium payments for commercial insurance with the carriers. And so I think most states have come out with guidance or mandates on that. I know we've spent an awful lot of time communicating with the clients and the carriers on allowing for that without cancellation. So the point being, you know, the premium accrued, but it's not going to be canceled if you don't pay, you know, between this time. Now, we are recommending that you document that and have it in writing and make sure that that's something that each individual gets approval on. However, it is something that we're seeing all the carriers react, I'll call it positively, to. And the second thing is, which is a little bit inconsistent with carrier response, is lowering your exposure midterm in your policy period, and meaning your sales levels or your payroll levels that often flow through the rates into your premiums, that if you can predict, and many can, we've either totally shut down or we're down 30% or whatever that numbers may be, and you can put together a reduction in exposures. Typically, carriers would wait till audit time at the end of the year and either assess an additional premium or return premium, but they're being asked, and we're pushing for carriers to do that midterm to give the relief. So not only defer premium payments, but possibly lower them based on lower exposures and not wait for return premium at audit time. And there are some, even on the health insurance side, there's some premium deferral actions that are happening. And so, you know, that obviously is, I'll call it immediate relief. You probably have seen nationally and maybe state by state, but on a national basis, I think today there was about up to 12 carriers that have come out with specific reductions for the 2 months, I believe May and June or April and May, some of them. So 2 months of a direct reduction in premium to commercial policies, and in some cases personal and commercial, most of them personal. And then in some cases now we're starting to see momentum towards just an automatic reduction for those 2 months to give relief. So I think what you're seeing is the carriers trying to do what they can, probably with the urging of regulators reduce or increase cash flow as much as possible for the premium payments. That seems to be what's moving quickly, or at least less frictional than the denials and so forth on the actual policies. So, Greg,
fire away.
Okay, one question. I don't know if you want to continue on that. I'm glad to do. I just wanted to put out to you and to the listeners that one other issue that's really created some activity for clients of ours and our work with carriers is the issue of vacancy clauses that are in property policies. And so for buildings that, you know, might have been shut down for business or remote staffed, there's clauses within these policies that in the typical spirit would be they want to ensure an occupied building, you know, when they go ahead and write and bind the coverage. But in this case, there's been a massive amount of buildings that have become unoccupied. And there's clauses in there that differ in language for 30 days, 60 days of vacancy. The definitions of vacancy are different across many policies. And so I'm not sure if you've been getting these questions at all, but we've been doing a lot of work with carriers to get them to waive those vacancy clauses, which in the spirit of it, of what's going on right now, we're having success doing that. In some cases, we haven't, and in most cases, we have. So I don't know if you have a comment on that or your thoughts on it, but I just wanted to bring that up as a kind of tied into the property policy.
I think it's such a tremendous insight. I haven't seen it come up as an aggressive point from any of the carriers just yet, and one thing I note about most of them is that they come with some interesting nuances that are often debatable, and I would say shouldn't apply for most situations that people are seeing here. However, it's not one of those things that I think you leave out there as a question mark as things proceed now, because sometimes that conclusion is a little bit more implicit than it is explicit. And for people who are creating a checklist of things that they should be doing, I would say that's right up there on the list as they're trying to have a dialogue with their carriers about how this is going to proceed. I think it absolutely should be on there as a talking point to say this is our expectation, that to the extent that we have a vacancy clause, it's our view that it should not it should not apply in this scenario, and we'd expect or hope for you to waive that if it's not, you know, not unreasonable for them to do so in this circumstance.
Yeah, correct. I think what we're
agree or not, but yeah.
Well, what we're finding from carriers is it's different by carrier. Some will verbally agree, and then we document. Some will in writing agree with some nuances that we're, you know, is better than not having it at all. And then there's some that have change the definition, which we're not happy with, to reduce maybe, you know, the definition from 30% unoccupied as being vacant to 10%, which to me doesn't, you know, to us doesn't do any good by having to count space or count, you know, count bodies, et cetera, or count furniture. So I think it's just the reason why I bring it, I think it's really important to get that waiver in writing and do everything you can as individual policyholder just to make sure that you have something to work with later on if a claim does occur, and at least you have something to argue about if it's a necessity to argue. I will tell you, generally speaking, the spirit from the carriers has been positive in terms of waiving it, not across the board, but that's been another area that they've been less frictional on.
Yeah. And a related note that I think is worth teasing out before I know I'm looking at the clock. I know we need to delve into cyber a little bit, but maybe to wrap up this portion, I have seen, not often, but seen on occasion already, certain carriers attempting retroactively to add either virus or communicable disease or pandemic-related exclusions or other types of limitations onto their policies. And I think that's it's something for people to be mindful of. I don't think it happens with a lot of frequency, but in most circumstances, that's inappropriate. And there are a lot of reasons why that should be discussed proactively if anybody becomes aware of those kinds of developments.
Yeah, I could add one more thing to that, Greg. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, all I was going to say is there's sort of two general circumstances, and it's important for people to be generally mindful if they have renewals coming up. The two circumstances being one, a policy that's midstream in force and effect in the middle of a policy period, but it can happen more likely as renewals come up. And a lot of people might have just passed a 4-1 renewal date is a common date for a lot of people. So be sensitive, have a dialogue with your insurance advisors about to make sure nothing like that is being retroactively added onto the policy.
I think that was my point was going to be what we're seeing is not as much the midterm. In fact, I can't say personally I'm aware of a midterm request, although I'm not saying it's not out there. I will tell you, though, we just had a meeting this morning with about 50 of our professionals on the checklist and the watching of renewals because especially when you get into, without getting too technical, claims made policies that pick up prior acts and involve such as D&O or E&O or EPLI coverages, right? So those are all typically claims made, and if renewal terms get changed in a way that might affect a virus exclusion or something like that to limit it, it could be very detrimental. So renewals is where we've been really keening in on to make sure that terms aren't put on the policy that with unintended consequences as far as we're concerned from our client's perspective.
Great point.
Thank you, guys. Before you guys move on to cyber, I think this is a pretty self-explanatory question, but I think it might be worth addressing. Can I get business insurance coverage, such as a business owner's policy, after the coronavirus-related loss occurs?
So you want me to tackle that, Greg, from a marketplace?
I think that is a little bit more of a market question, so please.
Okay. So the answer, generally speaking, is yes, meaning the market hasn't closed down for in order to get insurance. That being said, we've got several carriers that have limited their appetite for business, not only because of what's going on in overall, but I think also specific for new business, if you want to call it that, for them in those areas that have been hardest hit. For example, hotels as an example. I think the national statistic I heard today was that I think their occupancy rate is like 20% right now, so 80% reduction, and many of them are having to use the hotels for different purposes and in some cases working with states on additional housing based on hospital capacity and so forth. So exposures are changing in those industries strictly because of what's going on in restaurants, with takeout and deliveries and things like that. So my point is yes, the market's still open. Underwriting is going to be a little tighter, and you just have to work to make sure you tell your story and get yourself underwritten and in place, but it's available.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Greg, you want to start with the cyber portion?
Yeah, so I think it's a I want to just note before we do that there are a lot of different angles to the way COVID-19 is impacting businesses. And by kind of concentrating, business interruption is the mainstay. There's no doubt we appropriately devoted the amount of time we did to talking about that, and certainly could go on for longer. And cyber has really become an interesting one because of the unique way in which companies have had to adapt to stay-at-home orders and the present economic environment. But I want to make a note, there are a lot of other angles that are potentially worth keeping in mind as people are evaluating their insurance recovery options, executive lines coverage like directors and officers or directors and officers, employment practices, liability, workers' comp, general liability angles, depending on your workforce and your liabilities to third parties, as you generally understand, and this kind of rapidly mutating environment may create exposure on multiple fronts. So it is important to just keep all of those in mind, even though we're concentrating on a couple of key areas. But on the cyber front, in generally, what I think What's really become kind of the critical issue is that in a very unprecedented way, most companies are now being required to have their existing workforces work from home, and they're working on a variety of different networks, which individual companies may not have had the resources or time to be able to thoroughly vet, and that in turn is creating an increased exposure to all manner of cyber attacks and system infiltrations. And so the next question that I think we get a lot of people asking is, you know, how is that, if I carry cyber insurance or some sort of analogous coverage, like a kidnap and ransom for cyber, how do I envision that responding, and what are some of the concerns I should be wary of? And for it's hard to do a survey. I'd be curious to ask the audience how many people actually carry some form of cyber coverage now. But the main product, and Joe, I want you to supplement in here as soon as you can get me to shut up. The main product is really going to focus on liability that, when I say the main product, I mean a typical cyber product, is going to focus on the liability that you have for sensitive personal and corporate data, and to a certain extent, first-party exposures from network interruption issues. But it is the exposure of sensitive information that, at least from my vantage point, is of more significant concern, because people are working in new environments, they're working with new tech, and that gives hackers a lot of opportunities to exploit weaknesses and gain access to sensitive information. And one of the real challenges that can come up with many policies is that there can be limitations tied to the use of non-company-owned technology. People might be familiar with BYOD, that bring your own device. That's been a mainstay concern in the cyber insurance arena for as long as the product in its modern form has existed. And so now we're sort of seeing that concern be manifest on a very grand scale.
Yeah, so on the cyber piece, from the marketplace perspective, Greg, you're right. I think these policies, it's an emerging coverage still because of the emerging exposures that have occurred over the last several years in this area. And so what we find is that these policies, which I don't know the exact statistic, but 1 out of 5 businesses may have it, if that much. So there is some need to just look at whether this is an appropriate coverage for you as a business. But the policy forms are massively different, and so the definitions of these policies are just really, really hard to interpret. In fact, we would go to coverage counsel, like someone like Greg, often when negotiating terms with carriers and getting interpretations on definitions. Sometimes they can be that complex, and so we we're careful in terms of how we place this coverage. And so whatever current coverage you have, if you have it, it's a great time to pull out the form and go over it with your risk advisor. And you still can do endorsements to policies, not after a loss, but you can do them, meaning the market's still open for new business on cyber as well as endorsements, so to fill coverage gaps. However, they will underwrite what your infrastructure is and your info security team and policies that you have. So all those are good to look at right now. Hopefully, you either have an IT expert on staff or you hire external and are able to make sure your infrastructure is set up correctly. They're going to underwrite all that and price it based on what they get from you on that. I will tell you the second thing that and this could be endorsed on a couple different policies, but the criminal activity has picked up immensely from what we're hearing from our carriers. A lot of claims coming in due to employees or users responding to, little teasers like, how to work at home or buy masks or, COVID-19 update, et cetera. These types of things that people may double click on and open up a document and then create a problem for the for themselves and for the network are picked up right now, or just the activity is real high from what we're hearing from our carriers. However, the other thing to look at in your policy is, and there's all kinds of different terminology. We use the word social engineering, but essentially, it's the diversion of funds that may occur from your account to a criminal's account based on them phishing or incenting you to go ahead and divert monies. And that policy often is that's used is the crime policy. As Greg mentioned, cyber typically data-driven, privacy information-driven, third-party consequences, if you would, and the social engineering coverage is typically your money being diverted based on phishing, et cetera. So I just bring that up only because you should have cyber and crime reviewed at the same time and make sure that these holes are plugged if they're not covered right now on your current forms.
A great note.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate that.
You bet.
Greg, Joe, do you want to transition to questions, or do you have any other points that you want to make before we do that?
This is Joe. Let me just throw one other thing in that I didn't touch on, but I think Greg might have brought it up earlier, is your employment practice liability policies that you have, or if you don't have them, take a look at them. But obviously, with all the layoffs and furloughs that have gone on, a lot of activity has picked up in the labor world, and so we've been spending an awful lot of time in this. We have a labor attorney on staff and a compliance attorney on staff, and we spend an awful lot of time on how to lay off, and how to furlough, and what does that mean for all the different regulations and health insurance and COBRA, and all those questions pop up. And then there's this whole issue, Greg, we spoke about this in terms of if you've gotten a PPP loan and you want to bring back people in order to get loan forgiveness, what is that? How do I bring people back? Make sure you do it in a way that's compliant and ultimately the other issues regarding if someone gets sick on premises, et cetera. I bring this up only because the EPLI policies that are out there are somewhat similar to all the more matured than cyber coverage. But they also have their own nuances of, what's covered and what's excluded. And I just ask you to take that, review it with your advisor, your attorney, and your risk advisor, because you want to make sure you know what you have for coverage, and you want to get a labor consultant or an attorney to, I think, walk you through what you've done and what you're going to be doing as we hopefully open up this country a little bit and get people back to work. But I only bring it up because that market has tightened up extremely, obviously, with all the with the unemployment where it's at. And so that's a little tougher market right now than cyber, but still doable. You just have to be – it's just underwritten with high scrutiny. So just make sure you pay attention to that exposure as well.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. Sure. Greg, you ready to transition to questions? Do you have any final remarks?
Let's
before
do it.
We do that?
No, let's
yeah,
go
right. Sandy, do you want to open the line to questions at this time?
Sure. Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question over the phone, please press star 1. Please ensure your phone is unmuted and record your name to ask a question. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. One moment while we wait for questions to come in.
Sandy, it might take a second or few to get yep. a question. I just wanted to mention, Joe's mentioned it, and I think Greg a few times, the Paycheck Protection Program and under the CARES Act, and a really good resource in Connecticut for that. And if you're not in Connecticut, the SBDC network has really good information on the federal programs under the CARES Act and the resource guides and all of that information, as well as the state programs as well. So I definitely encourage you to take a look at that if you have questions. In Connecticut, it's the ctsbdc.com, and they have a COVID-19 business resource center. And most states have those resource centers up and running, so definitely take a look at that. And if you can't find a link, you can go to the ctexporters.com landing page that has all the resources from our last 3 weeks of conference calls, which we did one on the CARES Act. Do we have any questions?
No, there are currently no questions in the queue. Once again, if you'd all like right. to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name. Oh, here comes one, I think.
Perfect.
Okay, Okay, the first question comes from Peter Barclay. You may go ahead.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Hello, not bad. I'm a owner of a company in Grand Rapids, and we had to shut down here because of the shelter-in-place order by the governor, and we do have business interruption coverage. So far, our agent is telling us there's no coverage because of the governmental action. However, if we actually had a case in our plant and we're shut down by the health department, we probably have coverage. Does that sound right? Or, I mean, I don't know if you can answer that without actually seeing the language in the policy, but that's what I'm being told. I also put them on notice in writing because we did file for the PPP, and I understand that the governor or the government may be looking that we've tried to pursue all possible avenues for business loss. When they do the forgiveness.
Greg, do you want to tackle the coverage question? Or?
Yeah, so I think the so Peter, thanks. That is I really appreciate you sharing that perspective because I think it's probably the same one that everybody else on the phone is experiencing to some degree. And what I say is your question was, does that sound right? I think that is a not uncommon answer. Yes, you noted it right off the bat. The real answer is going to be driven by your policy. That's not I think an atypical response for what most policies will have. But I think I think you said you've done this. You've at least put the carrier on notice. I would, if you haven't gone so far as to actually get a denial from them, I would make sure that comes back, if for no other reason than to see in writing what their position is on your coverage so you can evaluate how to respond to that. In the absence of, some specific belief that that COVID-19 was actually in your space, it makes for a more challenging issue on the direct physical loss angle that we talked about earlier. And one of the things I would certainly want to do, though, is if I were in your shoes, and I don't know this off the top of my head, but is I'd want to be taking a look at Michigan law on some of those key issues, because I think how the law is going to interpret that question and possibly the significance of the government's directive can be critical. Some courts will talk about the idea that a direct physical loss does not necessarily require a tangible, traditionally tangible harm, that something akin to a loss of functionality can qualify. And it's possible, depending on your circumstances and potentially favorable law, that you have an argument.
Yeah, Greg, just to clarify on Peter's question, I'm unaware that whether it's the difference between, let's just say, the health department and the governor's office. I believe it has more to do with the peril, if you want to call it that, and the policy interpretation within the state that Greg was talking about. I'm just unaware of health. If the health department shuts you down versus the governor's office, I'm unaware of a policy form that would differentiate between those two. But I think it comes more down to the peril.
Oh, thanks, Joe. And I'm sorry if I missed that subtlety, Peter. But yeah, I think Joe's comment's absolutely right. And I'm not sure that the typical language gets that granular to make a distinction between whether it's a directive coming from the governor or some other agency that's cloaked with governmental authority.
So, and Peter, just to dovetail the second, I think there was a second part of your question that involved the PPP. So far, we've done a lot of work with lenders and clients on the PPP. I have not heard of a lender that is underwriting the issuance of approvals based on, having to put a property claim in or utilizing all other, resources. I think I know the spirit of what they're saying is that you have to have a need and certify you have a need and you've tried to, do what you needed to do. However, we've gotten many approvals or our clients have gotten many approvals and not put property claims in. It's not saying you shouldn't put the property claim in, but I don't think it's interdependent as closely as you implied with the PPP. I would go after the PPP in and of itself based on your situation.
Oh, we did file for the PPP. It was a webinar I listened to. They said when the government looks at it, you know, down the road as to whether or not you're entitled to a forgiveness of debt, they may want to see if you had business interruption insurance, whether or not you filed a claim and pursued all avenues to get reimbursed for business losses.
Okay, I have not heard that, but that could be good advice. I wouldn't say anything against it. But I've heard the, you know, we've read the rules as most people have, most businesses have, in terms of the forgiveness requirements. But I think what you're touching on, which is that, you know, there's maybe some additional proof that you had exhausted all other options. I have not heard of that, but I wouldn't work against it. It can't hurt you to put the property claim in.
Right. So I did. All I got was a response from my agent. I did not get a response from the carrier, so I should ask him to submit a claim to the carrier.
Absolutely.
And get a denial.
Absolutely.
Letter.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, Greg can tell you better than I could. I would have a formal claim put into the carrier. You can report it directly if you're having trouble for whatever reason. But you're going to get a letter back from the carrier. That's either going to be a denial, reservation of rights, or maybe not. But you want that in writing from the carrier. You don't want to take it from the agent.
Okay, very good.
Thank you for the question.
You bet.
Andy, do we have any other questions?
No, there are no other questions currently. If you'd like to ask a question,
please
press star 1 and unmute your phone and record your name.
We'll give it a few seconds to see if we have any final questions. Joe or Greg, do you want to make any final remarks while we wait for any additional questions?
Greg, do you want to go?
I don't mind. Yeah, I don't mind. I think it's I may have said this in some form or fashion so far, but it's really worth emphasizing. It's important in times like these to really, wherever you can, find a couple of minutes to sort of stop and think carefully about all the ways in which you're experiencing an impact here, and understanding how that fits against the program that you already have in place. Because this is unprecedented in many ways. And I think there are not going to be a lot of simple answers. And so, a careful, sort of fresh perspective on how the nature of this risk is developing in discrete specific ways, meaning, you know, how are these circumstances costing your business dollars? How is it opening up the company to potential liability issues? It's really going to be key to understanding how to maximize what's available through your insurance program.
I'll just add for one quick comment, and we've already said it, but I do think it's important that obviously we're all spending a lot of time on current policies and different ways of cash flow relief or recovery. I will tell you, I'm very concerned about renewal activity for these businesses that are already in distress, and just make sure you start early and get a lot of good communication about what's going on in the marketplace with your advisor or your agent. It's important you don't let it get down to the last minute and find yourself in a scenario where, as distressed as we all are, that there's coverage that's not available going forward, or premium increases that are unacceptable or undigestible. So just work ahead of the game. That's all.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. Sandy, do we have any final questions?
No, there are no final questions.
All right, very good.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Joe and Greg. Appreciate your time today. It was really enlightening conversation, great dialogue. If anyone has any questions for us or they need to get in touch with Joe or Greg, send me an email, and I'll be happy to put you in touch with them. Have a good day, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tony. Be safe, everyone.
That concludes today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect.